When the servant came to announce that dinner was ready, I let him repeat his mechanical formula several times, then I bolted the door and prepared my own meal. After dinner I slept for several hours, and about 10 minutes before 11 o'clock in the evening joined Naobu. We both walked over to the temple building to attend the daily service in the temple. I briefly told him about the audience, but he seemed to have been informed of it already. I hope you are convinced by now that the exalted jewel is a powerful spiritual leader, he observed. Yes, I replied, holding back the opinion that I still had to find out about him the most important fact, viz. Whether he served the cause of light or the cause of shadow. The whole evening I had been in the grip of grave doubts as to the real nature of the whole Brotherhood of Light. It was dark night when we passed the circular wall surrounding the shaft in the center of the holy city. This shaft must be very deep, I observed. How do you know it is a shaft? Asked Naobu. I have explored it a little, I answered. He seemed greatly surprised. It is immeasurably deep, he observed, but no one except the Prince of Light and a few of the highest initiates who are called Lords of Compassion know where it leads to. Anyone who would find out where it leads to and what it is used for would have to die. There are such secrets. Who would kill him? No one. He would die automatically the following night. We arrived at the temple building and descended the staircase. The small hall in front of the golden double door leading to the temple was dimly lit by torches held by servants, none of whom was allowed to enter the holy Lakhang footnote. There were several servants helping the members to take off their shoes. They knelt down before them and washed their feet. Services had to be attended barefooted. Other servants sprayed the naked feet of the hierophants with an abundant supply of perfume. I could not help smiling. A master of ceremonies dressed in black silk distributed the ceremonial robes to the temple goers. They were somewhat simpler than the ones I had seen in the palace, but somewhat smaller and embroidered with silver. When I looked at these people going in such robes to the service, I thought of a requiem said in a Catholic church. Court officials had informed the master of footnote, House of God. Ceremonies that I was allowed to enter without putting on a black silk robe and without taking off my shoes. It was quite an exceptional thing that such a permit had been granted by the ruler. Later, during the service, I must have looked like a bright spot in the darkness. Everybody else was dressed in black silk. One was the only person present who wore a chupa footnote, of the cheapest kind, which was made of cotton and remarkably light in color. After having been thoroughly fumigated by a servant armed with a perfume sprayer, I passed the outer door of the temple. It was a few minutes to 11. Another master of ceremonies, armed with a substantial-looking stick inlaid with gold and precious stones and having a human skull at the top, approached and informed me in whispers that it was strictly forbidden to talk or even to whisper inside the temple, and that it was considered a serious offense even to look at the other participants in the service. He hoped I would comply with these rules. The alternative, he added this with the greatest politeness, was a respectful and humble request to leave the temple immediately. He bowed almost obsequiously, and I passed the inner door of the temple. I should like to mention in this connection that bows in the holy city are quite different from the usual Tibetan greetings. People in the city practically never raise their folded hands to their foreheads, mouths, and hearts, which is frequently seen else footnote. Gownwear, and also the Tibetan prostration commonly called Kyagchag, is only used during divine service in the holy city. The House of God measured about 25 yards by 40. There were 9 large doors in the 3 walls opposite and right and left from the entrance. They stood wide open, and one could see that they gave access to 9 underground tunnels at least several hundred yards long and running out slightly downhill into the bowels of the earth as far as the eye could see. A kind of altar with a perpetual light burning on it stood in the center of the temple, and 4 long tables ran out from this center forming a large cross. The hierophants sat at these tables. I wanted to sit near Naobu, but the places were assigned by masters of ceremony and no participant in the service had the right to choose his place himself. About 200 members were present already when I took the seat assigned to me. The walls of the temple were adorned with inscriptions in Tibetan, and I spent quite a few minutes in reading them. I understood some of them, but failed to understand others. One of them read, "Give your soul to the master and he will show you the light." I thought of a man buying a cat in a bag. Another one read, "Distrust your brain. Deep understanding is beyond intelligence." This only increased my desire to trust my brain. Another inscription ran, "Blessed be you who suffer. Come to me and I will give you relief." And another, "Everything is unreal, only my own words are real." This inscription, I thought irreverently, was none too modest. The service began by the ringing of bells. The effect of this peal of bells rung far away in the underground tunnels was prodigious. Then a very high initiate wearing a costly white silk robe solemnly walked up from the northern wall of the temple towards the central altar. His train was held by several minor initiates. He performed queer rites and movements, his assistants touching the ground behind him with their heads most of the time. The audience alternately rose to their feet like a well-trained body of soldiers, then sat down again or touched the ground with their heads. These three poses alternated in fairly rapid succession. Bells were rung from time to time, and incense was burned repeatedly. On one occasion the priest walked round the altar seven times, swinging the incense burner all the time. Towards the end of the service, small pills made of rice were consecrated by the priest and the members of the brotherhood, one by one, walked up to the altar and each took a consecrated pill from a golden plate and swallowed it with great devotion, walking back to his seat immediately afterwards. Towards the end of the service, an initiate who carried a silver receptacle came out from one of the tunnels and handed it to the priest, who put it on the altar, consecrated it with great profusion of Sungpa's footnote, and then poured out its contents into several hundred small vases, apparently made of footnote, magical signs, pure gold, and held up to him on trays by the assistants. I strained my eyes a little to find out something about the nature of the liquid while it was being poured out. It was blood red. Naobu told me afterwards that it actually was blood. When I asked him what kind of blood, he said he was not allowed to answer. Then the procession started again, the hierophants one by one going up to the altar and emptying the contents of one vase each with great devotion. This closed the service. There was a mighty peal of underground bells, and the priest and his assistants who bore his train withdrew in a ceremonious fashion and entered the central tunnel in the northern wall of the temple, after having sprinkled the audience with an abundant supply of holy water. The brothers walked out in solemn procession, none of them daring to look at anyone else. When going out, I noticed that the lower part of all the walls of the temple was an uninterrupted succession of silver-edged glass cases entirely filled with human bones. A rapid calculation showed that the temple contained so and so many truckloads of human bones. Needless to say, I had not gone up to the altar, and had merely stood up and sat down from time to time out of politeness. After a short talk with Nabu, I went to bed. It was about midnight. I slept deeply, and about 10 o'clock in the morning I set out for a long walk in the neighborhood. I took along some food, intending to return in the afternoon. I felt quite fit and by noon I was at a distance of at least 7.5 miles from the city when I heard the rumble of thunder in the distance. I had left my tent in the holy city, and for the first time during my travels in Tibet I had nothing to protect myself from a Tibetan thunderstorm, which usually is very violent. When I had walked back a few miles towards the city, I was overtaken by the thunderstorm. There was absolutely nothing that could have been used to afford shelter, so all I could do was to lie down flat on the ground and wait for the storm to pass. The thunderstorm was unusually violent. Flashes of lightning followed one another in rapid succession, and after about 5 minutes one was literally drenched to the skin. As I dislike walking about in drenched clothes, I stripped them off, made a bundle of everything I had on me, and greatly enjoyed this unexpected shower bath. Fortunately, there was no hail, and after about half an hour the thunderstorm had passed and the sun came out. One wrung out my clothes and spread them out. It was about 1 p.m. The temperature in the sun was something like 50 degrees centigrade, and in the intense heat the clothes dried with remarkable rapidity. By about 3 they were fairly dry. I put them on and, after a meal of sambor footnote, soaked in water, walked back to the city. Those of my readers who are versed in occultism may know that there is no better occult disinfectant than water, and especially water Corning footnote, barley meal. Down from the sky. It washes away all magnetic currents sent into one's body and into one's clothes by outward agents. Water absorbs magnetic currents with great eagerness. Footnote. It is an occult purifier par excellence. Backslash the thunderstorm must have demagnetized me, if I may use that word, and washed away most of the magical currents which had no doubt been brought to bear on me during the last few days. When I had returned to the city, it seemed to me as if my capacity to view things in an absolutely matter-of-fact way had considerably increased. I went to the residential building of the members of the Brotherhood where guests were not allowed to enter. When I arrived, I found that the superintendent had already been informed that the Prince of Light had granted permission for me to visit the library where usually only members of the fraternity are admitted. Organization in the city seemed to be faultless. Nothing was ever overlooked. Everything seemed to be planned and organized and footnote. It is a well-known fact that various dogmatic religions, such as the Catholic Church and Lamaistic Buddhism, discouraged the practice of bailing for many centuries. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church took up a vigorous stand against the immoral practice of bathing, and the lamas up to this day greatly encourage the fear of water entertained by the Tibetan multitude when the use of water is recommended for cleansing the body. One may wonder whether these organized religions took or take such an attitude because they realize that human bodies are demagnetized and cleaned of certain occult currents by the practice of bathing, thus making it more difficult for them to maintain their spiritual control of the multitude. As far as the Catholic Church is concerned, they are a much too practical body to maintain an attitude which would seem too incongruous with the period in which we live. That is why the Catholic Church now no longer takes a stand against bathing, but the lamas still do so. If that is why it is used for making holy water in temples and churches. Recorded. Things in an anthill could not work more smoothly, I thought. Naobu happened to be in the library, and rose to greet me. The walk, the neutral atmosphere outside the city, and the good wash-up seemed to have increased my capacity to examine things objectively. Naobu's eyes seemed to have become a little more lifeless. It was as if an occult magneto had drawn out of him all that was best in him, his soul, his freedom, his personality. I listened to his voice. It sounded metallic and more soulless than it had sounded in his song. I told him that I had been out for a walk. While I talked to him, I began to listen to the sound of my own voice. It had a metallic and coated touch too. It was not hoarseness, oh no, it was a much more dreadful thing. I left Naobu, who was studying a manuscript written in Sanskrit, and went over to a mirror. When I saw myself, I stepped back aghast. Never before had I seen my eyes, the windows of the soul, gazing so lifelessly. Where was I? There was something strange about my features too. There was something of the grin of a demon in them. What did all that mean? I walked round the circular library building, brilliantly lit by the daylight flooding in through the ceiling. I examined the pictures on the walls. There were reproductions of various soul saviors and redeemers of past ages. There were pictures which seemed to be enlarged reproductions of the Supreme Jewel and his foremost lieutenants. I looked into their eyes. They were beautiful but gloomy. Allel was there, intelligence, power, but no soul. Everything in me cried out in one wild agony. I sat down and put my hands before my face. I had recognized the nature of all these saviors of souls. They were fallen angels. They were angels who had lost their glory because they had wanted to be like God. And when they had thus precipitated themselves into the bottomless abyss from which there is no return, just like a mountain climber who makes a dash to soar to the sun but falls down into the abyss, the fallen angels turned against the Creator and now live for the purpose of making others share their dreadful fate by dragging them down with them into the abyss. The Prince of Light was really the Prince of Darkness in disguise. The few minutes following this realization were the most dreadful of my life. My whole being cried out in spiritual agony. Outwardly I was quiet and composed, but inwardly I was in the grip of a spiritual storm shaking the very foundations of my being. So intense was my agony that it is beyond the power of words to convey a description of it. Only people who have had a glimpse of the spiritual can realize what the term soul agony of the greatest intensity really means. It was as if the experience of hundreds of incarnations, the suffering of whole existences, was concentrated into the space of a few minutes of spiritual anguish. So intense was my agony that it must have disturbed the whole psychical atmosphere of the City of the Initiates. I now positively felt powerful magnetic currents rushing on me from all sides to extinguish this newly acquired spiritual realization. A door opened and the prince entered the library, attended by only two secretaries. Everybody rose to his feet. Footnote. He came up to me. "Have you taken your decision?" he asked in a beautiful but dreadfully hollow and metallic voice. "Yes," I answered firmly. He blew one mighty breath right into my face. "Confounded sorcerer," I thought, "now you reveal your real nature." A left step back. "In the name of the Creator," I almost shouted in a mighty voice. I think never before had I heard my own voice so full of vigor and soul power. My whole being fused into one indissoluble unit, and my whole self lay in that voice. The ruler recoiled. He then briskly turned and left the library. I suddenly realized that the penalty for recognizing the real nature of such a being must be death. Footnote. I have explained before that the palace was connected with the other buildings by subterranean passages. The prince could thus reach any other part of the underground city in a few minutes. Blowing into another man's face is a certain characteristic of demons or their servants or disciples incarnated in the flesh. By these means they try to get hold of their man and obtain a good basis for subsequent magical operations destined to deprive him of his free will. The best spiritual armor against this dreadful practice is an iron will, intense iron soul consciousness, and the mental attitude of "may the Creator punish you for that without hatred." I. The best physical remedy against blows by demons is the eating of beans, bread prepared with much yeast, and similar kinds of food which produce abundant gases inside the body. Having failed to snatch my soul while I was alive and had the protective shield of my intelligence, he would no doubt try to murder me by occult practices, as it might be easier for him to snatch my soul on the other side. I had always possessed courage. Once a gun had gone off a few inches from my face, the bullet passing my nose, but friends had assured me that I had hardly moved my eyelashes. I have been to the most deserted parts of the world alone, carrying my own food to last 15 days when I knew that a sprained ankle or some other minor accident would mean certain death. I have been face to face with death many times without showing the slightest emotion. But now it was a different matter. I was not fighting for life, but for my soul. It was as if a bottomless abyss had opened before my feet and a cold hand tried to tear open my heart and to draw me away from the Creator forever. For the first time in my life I fled in terror. When running out to reach my room to fetch my belongings and leave the city, never to return, I made the mistake of running towards the sanitation building instead of the guest house. As said before, all the buildings in the city were alike from outside. I ran downstairs, passing with lightning rapidity through the two corridors corresponding to the ones I used to take when going to my room in the guest house. I had not realized that one was in the wrong building, and when two servants got up to stop me I simply pushed them aside with as little violence as was absolutely necessary. Footnote. And opened a door. I was in the kitchen of the city, to which no one except the kitchen staff and the highest initiates had access. A human corpse lay in the center of the kitchen. Lifeless and automaton-like cooks cut off small pieces of flesh. 10 or 15 large pans made of massive silver were suspended over so many fires apparently fed with alcohol, and the pieces of human flesh were passed on to boards where they were carefully cut up into small pieces. It was not quite certain, of course, that the contents of the silver pans were destined for the members and guests of the holy city, but the very possibility of my having partaken of such food was dreadful. If human flesh was actually mixed into our food, it was small wonder that it had disagreed with me. The cooks gave a mighty stare at the intruder, but 2 or 3 seconds were enough to have a look at the whole kitchen, and I immediately rushed back to the guest house. Narbu had followed me from the library. He had lost sight of me and now anxiously looked round in all directions while he stood before the guest house. "Wait here, please," I cried, and a minute later I was back with my belongings, including the urine bottle, which I did not want to leave behind as I realized that it would provide an excellent basis for magical operations directed against me. Footnote: I always avoid unnecessary harshness. Narbu accompanied me out of the city to the slabs displaying the inscription, "Border." After all, it was he who had invited me, and it was up to him to see me safely to the precincts of the city. "So you are going," said Narbu sadly. The poor, kind-hearted man won. He thought he was in the city of a great light power, and the thought that I did not want salvation made him sad. For a moment I contemplated whether I should tell him bluntly that he really was in the city of the evil one, but strange to say I felt that I could not, for spiritual realizations entail enormous spiritual responsibilities. Even the powers of evil have their spiritual mission. They snatch souls if men themselves give them up. By his spiritual sins, footnote, man himself weakens the ties which link him to his soul, and the more he sins spiritually, the more he strikes himself with blindness until he can no longer see the difference between God and the Creator, no matter how high are his occult accomplishments. The devil tempts, but he can only seize souls that voluntarily yield to his temptation. That is a law of the universe. I felt I could save no one from the evil one. By telling Narbu that the exalted jewel was identical with the Prince of Darkness, I should have influenced his spiritual attitude and interfered with his spiritual destiny, which lay in his own hands. I felt I had no right to do that, for the supreme spiritual law is absolutely footnote. Using the impersonal for personal uses, selfish prayers, and wanting to be like God are the 2 most frequent spiritual sins. Free choice by every individual. Man himself can choose resplendent light, but he himself can also throw himself down into the bottomless abyss from whence there is no return. Oh, the dreadful tragedies of spiritual life! One, there stood Narbu, kind-hearted and only afflicted with a slight dose of spiritual arrogance, but otherwise good at the core. He wanted to save me, although it was he himself who needed salvation, and I could not save him. I had to leave him to his fate. I felt the dreadful tragedy of the moment when I greeted him and went on my way. Just as the tiniest creature has its mission in the universe, every spiritual force, be it one belonging to the upward trend of life or to the downward, has its mission too. It is bound by spiritual laws which are inherent to its very nature. No special oath is required to keep it within these bounds. No spiritual creature can act in a way contrary to its spiritual nature. God and devil both go their own way, and the creature can seize at will the upward or downward trend of life. The more he sins against his soul, the more he will strike himself with blindness. But once he goes to his doom, no one can save him. I had been for 3 days in the city of the initiates, but the experience of whole decades seemed to have been crowded into these 3 momentous days. Footnote. Kind-hearted Narbu died suddenly some time after I had left the holy city. It was not necessary for me, therefore, to hold back certain secrets out of consideration for him. Chapter 5. The flight. I turned towards the region where my Tibetan hermit friend lived, whose brother had procured me Tibetan clothes south of the Gobi Desert. I felt that the ruler of the holy city would not feel safe while I lived, and as it was quite impossible for him to have me murdered openly, be it only out of consideration for Narbu, whose eyes might have been opened by such an occurrence, he would no doubt try to kill me by powerful magical operations. Even attacks of this kind become more difficult when the distance separating the magician from his enemy increases, and as I had no desire to fight these currents more than was absolutely necessary, I intended to set out at the rate of about 30 miles a day and take a rest upon my arrival in the abode of the wise hermit. It was late in the evening, and as soon as night had fallen I put up my tent at a place about 8 miles distant from the underground city. I naturally chose a place where one was hidden by small ridges. I knew that the magical attacks I had to expect would in all probability be brought to bear during the night, about 12 to 1 being the worst hours, and that so long as I remained awake and 155 from families living in the district, and instead of cutting them up they had devised some trick to steal the dead bodies and smuggle them into the city under the cover of night, the people coming from the city had arrived. I recognized them by their resplendent black robes. They were masters in the occult brotherhood. They knelt down near the lifeless bodies and then magical operations were started to resuscitate them. I am sorry, I must withhold a few details relative to these practices, for some of the operations were so disgusting that I must abstain from giving a description, be it even in Latin. After strenuous work greatly varying in duration, 3 of the lifeless bodies had begun to move and walked on towards the city mechanically, like so many robots, led on by one of the masters. Were the lifeless bodies really dead before the resuscitation practices were started? If so, it was dreadful to imagine what kind of servants had cleaned my room and prepared the food in the holy city. 15 other lifeless bodies where the resuscitation practices had failed to take effect were carried on towards the holy city. Being of a practical disposition, the exalted jewel possibly did not wish to lose a single lifeless body he had obtained by trickery or by bribery. Those which were past hope may have been sent to the kitchen and their bones to the temple. Dreadful. As soon as the procession, preceded by the walking robots led by the masters, had disappeared from sight, I approached to ascertain whether the stretchers and numerous footsteps had left some traces on the ground. The experience had been so unusual that I wished to check up whether I could believe the evidence of my senses. After inspecting the footprints very thoroughly, I marched on. Why on earth did these people perform those dreadful ceremonies in broad daylight? They had a whole underground city where they could do all they liked, surrounded as they were by walking automatons who could never betray them. And even if such ceremonies could not be performed underground for some reason or other, why did they perform them in broad daylight? True, the chances of meeting someone in that forlorn part were exceedingly small, but, small as they were, why did they run that risk at all? Thinking further along these lines while I walked on, I came to the conclusion that if such clever rogues took any chances at all, they must have had an imperative reason for doing so. The waking up ceremonies were performed in the light of the sun that had just risen. This seemed to indicate that the cosmical currents they needed for their dreadful purpose reached their greatest intensity soon after sunrise. Sunrise and noon are the hours of God, sunset and midnight's the hours of darkness. The devils stole cosmic forces from the Creator, then, to accomplish their own horrible work. As usual, the evil one is strongest when he snatches away the forces of the Creator and uses divine forces to his own end. Of course, all these speculations were based on the assumption that the Lagpass footnote had really escorted dead bodies. I walked on at top speed, and once more reviewed the happenings of the last 3 days. Why had I been saved? I had come to the city on the invitation and recommendation of Narabu, who was himself misled and failed to realize the real nature of the Brotherhood. I had entered the city in a disinterested spirit to help and not in order to get something. My lion temperament had revolted when they proposed to hang round me the black ceremonial robes which were in all probability magnetized too. Allel their subtle magic, mesmerized food and maybe even other tricks I knew nothing about, had failed to produce the occult results they desired. Because throughout my stay in the city I had never sinned, be it even in thought. The evil one can only take those who give themselves voluntarily up to him, and where he oversteps that limit there are angels of the Creator who protect the innocent. They had tried to snatch my soul away. I love my soul, through which the Creator speaks to me through my heart. The harder they worked to snatch it away the more desperately I clung to it. Great fires, like other turmoils in life, may destroy the weak, but they purify the strong and make him still stronger. More and more I began to be aware of the fact that life, including life on spiritual planes, was not an affair of peaceful contemplation and quiet worship, but a dreadful turmoil, a grim fight, and a bitter struggle. Footnote. Corpse Cutters.